Chapter 8. John Corabi. A freshman, hazed by his seniors, discovers their true nature after a night of humiliation at the hands of the town harlots. After Tommy and Nikki's binge, they committed themselves to sobriety so that they could try to repeat the success of Dr. Feelgood with Bob Rock in Vancouver. For them, there was no middle ground. Not only were alcohol and drugs forbidden, but so were red meat, cigarettes, and caffeine. We popped vitamins all day and worked out mornings with a trainer. But unavoidably, there were nights when we fell off the wagon. The first time was when Snake from Skid Row came up to visit us. Tommy, Nikki, Snake, and I hit a strip club and then a local bar. Nikki, who was already obliterated, asked the waitress how much the kamikazes were. She told him they were $3.50. So he reached into his pocket, handed her a fistful of bills, and said, "As much money as here, that's how many kamikazes I want." 15 minutes later, a group of waitresses walked up with 9 trays of kamikazes and arranged them on the table. We pounded them until we couldn't drink anymore and climbed into the band van. "Crab," Tommy asked me, "have you ever been with a hooker?" "No," I stammered. "Well, let's get you a hooker then." Life was so normal and easy when these guys were sober, but when they were fucked up, they'd squeeze a whole lifetime of adventure, mayhem, and decadence into a 12-hour span. On the way to Richard Street, where the prostitutes hung out, we pooled our money. I had $100, Tommy had $80, poor Snake had $600, and Nikki had $12 left over from his kamikaze binge. We pulled 4 really cute hookers into the van and took them back to the hotel to party. Tommy hooked the girls up with some weed, Nikki pulled out a couple bottles of Jack, and we started partying. Tommy was separated from Heather but wanted to call her and check in anyway. "When I come back," he said, "this party is going to fucking start." A half hour later, he pushed open the door and walked in with his pants around his ankles, yelling at the top of his lungs and bum-rushing one of the prostitutes. At that exact moment, one particularly bitchy hooker looked at her watch and said, "That'll be another $200 each." All of a sudden, the party went quiet, and the kind of dark, somber cloud that appears whenever anyone mentions money hung over the room. "What do you mean, $200? I asked. "It's been an hour, and it's $200 an hour." Nikki went ballistic. He threw his Jack Daniels bottle across the room, and it shattered on the wall over the bitchy hooker. He ran after her, threatening to slice her in half, and faster than you can say, "Don't go away mad," the room was girl-free. There were just the 4 of us left, sitting on the couch. The hookers had left with all our weed and money, and Nikki had thrown our last bottle of Jack against the wall. Snake popped open a beer from the minibar and shook his head. "Dudes, what just happened?" he asked. Then he smiled wickedly. "Yeah, the bad boys of rock and roll, Motley Crue and Skid Row, just had to pay girls $800 to talk to us. We're pathetic." Unbeknownst to me, Tommy and Nikki had decided that the night was not over. While Snake kept me busy with small talk, they snuck into the hotel kitchen and stole a 50-gallon vat of tomato sauce. Then they swiped my room key from the front desk, pulled the sheet back from my bed, covered my mattress with tomato sauce, and remade the bed. When I returned to my room that night, I noticed that it smelled like spaghetti, but didn't think anything of it. I pulled back the sheet and put my hand down on the bed, and it squelched in something. I looked at my hand, and it was covered with red like something out of The Exorcist. I was so drunk, however, that I thought if I ignored the tomato sauce, that would somehow show Tommy and Nikki that they hadn't gotten the better of me. So I went to sleep in it. The next morning, I left a box with 12 cream puffs outside Nikki's door and rang the bell. He opened the door, looked down the hall, then noticed the cream puffs. An hour later, I saw the empty cream puff box in the hallway. Then at the gym later that day, I watched him explain to the trainer why he felt too sluggish to do any of the exercises. After that, it was all out war with Nikki. He would take me out to a bar and get me drunk. Then, while I was talking to a girl, he'd take a taxi back to the hotel, fill my keyhole with Elmer's glue and broken matchsticks, and return to the bar. Once I was good and drunk, He'd bring me back home and watch out of his peephole while the hotel staff took my door off the hinges so I could crash for the night. I retaliated by putting a blow-up love doll on Nikki's door with a sign that said, "Welcome, sailors," and posting notices all over the hotel inviting single men to his room. Then Nikki pulled out all the stops. While I was sleeping, he spent several hours gluing an entire room service tray to my door, sticking on every plate, napkin, utensil, and even filling a glass with Elmer's glue so that it looked like milk. Then he doused my whole door with hairspray, set it on fire, knocked, and ran back to his room. Mick was always too smart for anyone to pull pranks on. He covered the hallway leading up to his room with flour so that he could track the footprints of anyone who dared to mess with him. That year was probably the best time of my life. Everyone was on new territory creatively and just having stupid, harmless fun. Mick had never worked with a second guitarist, Nikki had never worked with a second lyricist, and the band had never written songs through just jamming. We couldn't wait for Motley fans to hear what we'd done. We thought we had really made an intelligent Motley Crue record with a lot of commentary on the kooky shit going on in the world, from the Rodney King riots in LA to the latest fury over music censorship. The last song I wrote for the record was called Uncle Jack, which was about a relative of mine who had sexually molested my brothers and sisters. Just as we started recording, he was arrested and charged with statutory rape and sexual assault of 20 young children, all of which he had documented with pictures. But 2 months later, he was let out of jail because the wardens and the court were worried that the other inmates were going to kill him. So now that he was free, where did he find a new job? A Catholic elementary school. As we were finishing the record, my mother called and told me he had been arrested again. While teaching at the Catholic school, he had moved in with a woman and her two sons, aged 8 and 3. She worked at night and he worked during the day, so he spent most of his time unsupervised with them. After just a few months, the woman he was living with was killed in a car accident. When her ex-husband moved back into the house, he discovered that the guy had been sodomizing both boys. I was livid when I found out that he was still destroying all these people's lives, so Nikki said, "Why don't you want to write a song about it?" I wanted to release the song as a single and donate the money to Centers for Abused Children. We were ready to make a difference and show the world that Motley Crue was still a circus, but a circus with a heart. When we finished the record, we went on a press tour. Everywhere we traveled, fans went berserk. In Milan, a group of contest winners attacked me and started tearing off pieces of my clothing for souvenirs. I looked over at Nikki. "Get ready for it, Crab," he beamed. "It's going to be like this all the time."